Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, come rain, come snow, come storm, which we're experiencing today, the day before Thanksgiving. And if you hear wailing noises and winds, no, you're not having a transmission problem. And if you don't hear what's going on behind me, which is quite a storm here all around where I am, I'm glad because today's show, we have a very special guest and someone who I want you to be able to hear in all clarity. Today's Connect the Dots is actually featuring someone who holds the distinction. He holds many distinctions, but he's been on this show three times, promoting each time actually promoting one of his extraordinary books. And he's one of our most prolific authors. I'm speaking of Larry Dossey. The last time he was on Connect the Dots and its predecessor, Whole Person Healing, he was talking about the power of premonitions. Larry has written over 9 books, mostly bestsellers, all kind of awakening us to the larger context in which we exist and thrive and live. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk about different aspects of our connection to our total environment. And the biggest picture of our environment is what we're going to be talking about today with Larry. Let me tell you a little bit about him, and then we'll talk a little bit about his book before bringing him in. I'm so thrilled to have him here. Larry is also the former executive editor of the peer-reviewed journal Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine. His special niche has been really finding the scientific connections and proof that demonstrate the interconnectivity of non-local mind. This is science that's being done all around the world. It's only grown over time. Larry Dossey has been one of its prime explorers, presenters, popularizers and explicators. So, you know, for many people who maybe did not get raised in a traditional faith path or who have not been long-term meditators, if you have ideas about things being connected and about consciousness and all the rest of it, some of it undoubtedly comes from your own personal journey. But a lot of the conversation in the public space that we share about that has really been launched by Larry and his extraordinary work. He's here today to tell us about his latest book, which is really a fantastic next step in his incredible oeuvre. It's called One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. This is just recently out in hardcover. It's an extraordinary book. And I just want to say, because of the fact that I cover a lot of advocacy and activism and things that are that need adjustment and rebalancing in our values and in our society and in our world, and I'm a bit of a model for warrior action. Every warrior, male or female or of any age in our society, also needs to retain a connection to an understanding of the bigger picture in which we all function, or it really truly does become overwhelming. As a kind of warrior type person myself, I highly, highly value people like Larry, and Larry especially and particularly, for really not only telling us cognitively and giving us reasons to trust and connect to our own knowingness and to understand the scientific validity of what we're going to be discussing on today's show, but really for embodying the caring experience of it. And all who know him, as I have the pleasure to do, know that that's the true treasure, and it's also carried through all his writings as well as this next book, One Mind. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Larry Dossey.
Allison, it's just great to be on your program. It's wonderful to be back, and really thank you for the invitation. I hope you weather this storm. It sounds formidable.
It's a big, big thing that's going on here in the Northeast. It's like it makes it sounds like a haunted, you know, a classic on the dark and stormy night, except now it's 10 a.m. in the morning. So it's wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you. Great.
And you know, your work has been such a personal inspiration to me for such a long time, I have to say. And you know that. And, you know, the thing, since you began this work of awakening people to the reality of what we know and sense, but our kind of understanding of science has had a way of kind of divvying up things into little bits and parts such that we almost get disconnected from and distrust our own sensing, our own knowing, our own experience. And, you know, we feel that unless there's a study proving something, I'm kind of a woo-woo, or, you know, I don't have the right to kind of validate, you know, what we actually experience in terms of the connectedness that you're talking about. Can you, I mean, what you're describing is really an innate experience that many people have. Why do we doubt it? How have we come to doubt the presence of greater consciousness and our seamless interconnection with it?
Well, I think it's been due to the fact that essentially in the 20th century we were sort of mesmerized or hypnotized into thinking that we're all isolated and separate. We've made an obsession in this country of individual responsibility, and while that's quite wonderful as far as it goes, it really doesn't describe all we are as human beings. With respect to consciousness, in the 20th century, we just sort of took it apart. And everybody who's had a course in psychology in college or university knows that we talked about in the 20th century the conscious, the unconscious, the subconscious, the preconscious, the superego, id, and all the rest of it. And so one gets the idea that even when it comes to consciousness, that it's all bits and pieces. I think that's pretty much an illusion as far as the fundamental aspect of consciousness goes. It isn't separable. You can look through the other end of the telescope and come to an opposite conclusion, which has been a thread throughout human history, and including the great spiritual traditions in which people have this abiding, continual notion that consciousness is unitary, it's one, it's connected, and that's what I try to emphasize in this book, The One Mind. And I want to emphasize that this is not just California woo-woo or some poetic or metaphorical way of talking. As you've already implied, there is a tremendous database now in the hard science is showing that consciousness is truly connected, and we can split it apart for convenience if we want to, but when we do that, we really do a huge disservice to who we are.
Mm-hmm. How does that work? I mean, you know, if when we're splitting it up, we're sort of splitting it up and chopping it to pieces and studying it to understand it better, but what happens to our ability to connect with it and our sense about the ground for our being in reality when we do that?
Well, it can be devastating. For example, let's take the environmental movement. I consider myself, as you've already described yourself, as an activist, and I know that a lot of people have a sense of futility in the field of environmental activism. You know, you can change out all your light bulbs all you want and turn the thermostat down and all of this sort of thing. But at the end, a lot of people have this lingering idea that it just doesn't make any difference in the long run. And we get the idea that we're just bit players in all of this, that we're isolated, and although we may mean well, it just doesn't make a tremendous difference. I think it's possible to totally turn that around. And one way of doing this is to emphasize not our separation and our disunity, but our sense of connectedness and oneness and unity. There's a sense of power that comes from this. And not only is this a psychological advantage, but people are more creative and solution-oriented when they come together in groups. And so what I'm talking about is that this is not just an arithmetic thing. It's an exponential growth in the ability of people to get things done. You know that famous line from Margaret Mead in which she said, can a small committed group of people make a difference in the world? And she answered the question with, Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
Mm-hmm.
So we have everything to gain by emphasizing not just our separateness and individuality, although that's can be an advantage in certain situations, but our togetherness and our oneness. And also to realize that when we talk like that, we're not just talking poetically and metaphorically. We're talking about a living reality at some level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, even as ecologically, we're all interconnected. When one person, you know, kind of pees out their antidepressant medication, and it goes into, just to take the very, you know, the kind of a lower rung level here, and it goes into the water supply. And when millions of people do that, then millions of people are, you know, potentially, if this is not filtered for this purpose, which in most cases and in most places it is not, you know, then the end result is that we're all getting that medication. So even on a very primary biological level and an eco-biological level, we are all connected. And yet, because of what you're describing, this kind of slice and dice, we are hesitant or afraid to believe that in some way. What would a more synthesized and unitive scientific approach look like that could kind of help put this back together again?
Well, for one thing, we would develop a sense of connectedness, not just with other human beings, mm-hmm. which is quite wonderful, but with all of sentient life. Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk about many angles of evidence, threads of proof, which show that we're connected not just with individuals, but with animals, probably plants, and anything that has an ounce of sentience about it. If we were to really feel this in our heart, in our gut, this would make a tremendous difference in our level of caring for the rest of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Alice Walker said, anything we love can be saved. And so the question comes down, you know, what do we love, and how much do we love it? If we don't love something, we're probably not going to save it. And to the degree that we feel at one and with and connected with all sentient life, we're going to be able to commit greater effort to the great causes that are necessary. We're going to meet the challenges that we confront. And so this makes all the difference in the world. If you want to see the opposite, just look at the way we've tried to secede from nature. We're in the process of ruining the life-sustaining support systems that sustain us. We can't go on like this. And so I think the only thing that's going to save us is a profound ontological shift in how we view ourselves in relation to the rest of the sentient universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, one of the things about that is I think that death and our sense of death and that process and what happens and what that's about is really an important part of that, because sometimes, you know, when we're in a society where you're striving to be happy, you're striving to be successful, you're striving to have it all or attain certain benchmarks or, you know, all of those things outside ourselves that we've been taught to strive for, achieve, or that define us as people, then, you know, it's inevitable that people will, you know, as if we're all on a kind of sort of corporate treadmill going toward winning or profit or some, you know, some kind of happiness or success, some kind of end goal. It's kind of almost inevitable that people will then, you know, if you deal with sadness, if you deal with loss, if you deal with grief, if any of those things are going on in your life, as they are in everyone's, you know, at some time or another, you know, they're sort of to be brushed aside because they are, you know, kind of detracting from that treadmill race toward whatever, you know, we think we're aiming at. And with those things going out the door being characterized as negative, as, you know, or just things we shouldn't focus on if we're going to keep on that, you know, that they used to call it a rat race. I don't know if that's still called, if people still use that term so much. But, you know, when we do that, I think that we also lose touch with the very compassion, empathy, you know, sense of the preciousness and fragility and belovedness of all the, you know, of the people close to us, the animals, the species, all that you're talking about. So, you know, the way we, I don't think our society does a very good job with those things. And that, of course, is one of the areas that traditionally religions, you know, have, or spiritual traditions have offered some form of pathway, comfort, holding, understanding of those other dimensions. Would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, absolutely. I'm glad you bring up the issue of death, because this is one of the key areas that the One Mind idea has relevance for. I've been writing about different ways of viewing consciousness for some time, as you know, and I introduced the term non-local mind back in a book that was published in 1988 called Recovering the Soul. And it feeds into this idea of non-local mind in this way. Non-local mind is mind that's not localized to our brains or our bodies, and it isn't localized to the present moment. Non-local mind is just a fancy term for infinite mind. And think of it this way. If our minds are infinite in time, then they're eternal and they're immortal. And one of the new pictures of one mind, as opposed to their ordinary view of consciousness, is that eternality and immortality are a given. And many of the great spiritual traditions, at least in the esoteric side of them, have always expressed this. I know a lot of people, even who through their faith tradition believe in immortality and the soul, think that, well, you know, that's just something that kicks in when I die. From the one mind, non-local mind standpoint, it doesn't kick in when you die. It's present right now. We don't acquire immortality or immortality. It's a given. It comes as part of the original equipment. It's part of who we are. So I think this fear of death feeds into some of the problems that we face now, ecologically and environmentally, because it leads to consumption, mindless consumption. We want to acquire our stuff as much as we can before we fade from the scene and before death annihilates everything that we are. If we had the abiding belief that we're immortal already and eternal, I think a lot of that mindless behavior would be abated. So I think that those of us who are concerned about the fate of the earth and environmental issues and so on really need to take an interest in the nature of our consciousness, because it may be that that is the best hope we have of confronting these enormous challenges that we face.
So what would that look like?
Well, I think it takes the pressure off. This mm-hmm. idea that when we die, we're not annihilated. There's something that's non-local, that is to say temporally infinite, and it would change our behavior. In the ways that I've already implied. So
the consumptive behavior that you're talking about is kind of assuaging a fear of annihilation on some level.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And I must say that science has been complicit in aiding and abetting this idea that when we die, that's it. I mean, there's nothing survives, nothing that you consider you endures. I think that science has a lot to answer for, because the evidence, in my judgment, now compellingly demonstrates that there is some factor of consciousness that does endure. I think the psychology textbooks and the neurobiological textbooks are in the process of being rewritten to acknowledge this idea that something about us survives. The evidence is everywhere. First of all, it's intuitive. Most people throughout human history have believed in something that used to be called the soul. That term doesn't have much traction now because of the religious baggage to it. But we can talk about the evidence for non-local consciousness, which points like an arrow to immortality. We certainly see this in near-death experiences when people like neuroscientist and neurosurgeon Dr. Evan Alexander come back and talk about experiences on the so-called other side. But that's only part of it. Experiments now that have been done in consciousness research for four decades have shown that there's something about us that isn't confined to the brain. We can't explain the behavior of consciousness by referring it to what's going on in the brain. It just simply doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So there's something beyond the physical, something beyond the moment, that just doesn't behave as if it's physical at all. That's what we need to be focusing on, not this indirect neuromythology, as I call it, which says that everything is limited to the brain and its workings and its neurochemistry and so on. That idea is falling out of favor, and it's being replaced by this emerging concept of non-local versions of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not just a philosophical plaything that we're talking about here, Allison. I think that this is absolutely vital and crucial. This is not just a philosophical idea to be contemplated at leisure. I think we need to get on with this because I think our future probably depends upon it.
How can, you know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, how that can, I can really understand, and I'm sure our listeners can, how that shift in awareness can make it, you know, can be better for me, for us, for those of us who partake of it. But what happens then with this segment of the people, which I believe is not all the people, but, you know, a certain small group, deluding another slightly larger group and sort of monkeying with our infrastructures in a way that is kind of hard for us to get a handle back on. What about, you know, I mean, are we going to wait for John Boehner to, you know, sort of come to something in a dream or, you know, like, if so, let's concentrate on sending him that wisdom. But, you know, how is that going to affect some of these factors in our world that, you know, kind of do make people also feel overwhelmed and like, not sure how to get a handle on it?
Well, it's not a rational process. I mean, this is not like a bunch of dominoes where one, you know, falls and, you know, this is sequential and gets played out that way.
Right.
It doesn't work like this. I think it never has. I spent my life practicing internal medicine, and I remember back in the 1970s and 80s, when the alternative healthcare movement first began to gather steam, no one really had any idea that it would emerge as one of the great social transformations of the 20th century. But it has, and we now know that more people go to offices of some sort of alternative therapist every year than go to the offices of first-line practitioners, such as family physicians, OB-GYNs, pediatricians, and so on. Who would have thought it? This is an entirely irrational prediction back in the 70s and 80s, but it's come to pass. And so how does that sort of thing happen? I'm not sure anyone has a handle on it, but it is a fact of history that this is not an arithmetic progression. This is not a string of dominoes. I'll give you another example that has affected half the world. If you go back to Renaissance Italy and you try to understand how the Renaissance came into being, I remember when I was studying this in history in high school and college that I thought that, you know, the Italian nation just sort of woke up collectively and people just sort of changed their minds everywhere in Italy. It never happened that way. Historians now have identified a very small number of families in Italy in those pivotal years who woke up. And it's just a few families that changed the course of Western history. It's never been the fact that you have to get all of the John Boehners on board before something massively happens, I'm happy to say. You know, if that were the case, then I think we'd all just, you know, could fold up, because I think a lot of people would go to their graves swearing that most of us are just nuts, you know, but we don't have to convert all of those people. It's important to convert a few key decision makers, and then some alchemical process seems to kick in culturally, but this is not arithmetic. So, you know, we don't... We don't need to fold up our tents and just sort of give up the field because we can't get Boehner and McConnell and a few of those guys to come around, you know, I think that probably will never happen. Mm-hmm. But we don't have to. So there's some other principle that kicks in that gives us all hope. You know, I love a comment from the novelist Arundhati Roy. She said, another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. So that's it. You know, we need to keep our senses open and see if we can hear that world that's being born, breathing. And I agree with her that we can indeed if we listen very closely. But you see, this is where the one mind idea kind of comes to our aid, because it assures us that we're not isolated and that we are all connected. And so we need to let that strengthen us by becoming as real as we can permit it to be.
Yeah, I love that idea, too, because we are, in a sense, there's a an authenticity and truth-telling function there. Because if it's all sort of connected and known anyway, then the kinds of artifices that people don, if, you know, they're dealing with an other or others, kind of the need for that evaporates, you know, based on that. And I think that, you know, that's personally so, I feel it's so needed, and I think it's just what really connects people and brings us together and makes things alive. You know, what is, for people who are, and I know that many of my listeners are, as I am, followers of your work and readers of you know, your lineage of books, what for you was different and special in this book in terms of, you know, what you discovered in doing it and what it brings to people?
Well, it's been a fun book to write. I've been collecting material for this book for, oh gosh, you know, 30 years. It's sort of an autobiography in a way. I've put together things that I think are crucial for people to know if we're going to successfully negotiate the 21st century. I'll just give you one example that's meaningful to me about how minds come together and how you can't separate them, and it has to do with the fact that I'm an identical twin, and my twin brother and I have had experiences all of our lives in which we would sense things at a distance that the other person was feeling. And sometimes this even amounts to simultaneously experiencing physical symptoms and feelings, not just psychological stuff. And to perhaps compound that experience for me, I'm married to a twin. My wife Barbara is also a fraternal twin, and so she and her twin brother have had these sorts of experiences all of their life. One example I wrote about in the book to show how minds communicate across great distances is as if they're completely united, is a case that dates to the 1970s in Spain, and it involved two little twin girls who were 4 years old. Their names were Sylvia and Marta. And what happened is that one day the father took one of the little girls off to visit the grandparents, who were tens of miles away, and the other little girl stayed home to help her mother with household chores. And unfortunately, she touched her hand to a red-hot iron and immediately erupted in a big second-degree burn on one part of her hand, a huge blister. And simultaneously, at the same time, tens of miles away, the other little twin girl, having no knowledge, of course, of what had happened to her twin sister, immediately erupted in a second-degree burn on the same hand in the same pattern on the same area of the hand. Now, this is weird stuff. You know, there's no theory known to neuroscience that could explain how this could happen. This is an example of what's been called in consciousness research as a telesomatic event, which is Latin words combined that mean the distant body. It's as if a single mind is manifesting in different bodies that are separated. There are hundreds of these kinds of cases that have been reported in the literature over the years, and they clearly show, in my judgment, that something connects us at a distance for which there's no physical explanation. And if you look at these cases, Allison, they have one thing in common, which is just you can't miss it if you wade through this literature. It's an emotional connection, a sense of oneness at an emotional level. People who feel loving and compassionate toward each other, as identical twins often do, this seems to be the glue, so to speak, that unites people across great distances. And what I want to call the one mind, and this is only one thread of about 30 different examples of evidence that I talk about in the book that allows us to see consciousness in a different way, a way through which we're united and not fundamentally separate.
Well, this is speaking to me very personally in a kind of synchronistic manner. And I hesitate to bring this up, but hey, why not? Yeah. Well, I happen to have had the wonderful experience of, for 15 years, having two cats who appear to be fraternal twins. They were, clearly litter mates. They're the only two from that litter that strongly resemble each other. Obviously, they had the same father, which couldn't be said for maybe their other siblings. And so, in effect, I've been raising twin kitties, or had the companionship of these wonderful twins, felines. And the girl has, in the last couple of weeks, at the age of 15, very sadly passed. And her brother is still here. And I am always, I can see that, we're in a mourning process together, but I also see how beyond their individuality, that he and she are kind of part of the same something. I mean, right. It's not just they're separate individuals, and it's kind of like there's a themness in their twinship that's connected and that's still connected. And I am so wondering what he is experiencing, how it is for him, and what an animal, the presumption is the animal knows less and we have to kind of try to explain to him. But I wonder if they're in contact, if he knows more, or what he might be experiencing. Now that's a hardball question. I apologize. But I just, this is just when you're bringing up twins and the whole thing, this has been, my contemplation for the last several weeks. So I have to kind of chime in and ask, even if it is a kind of unusual question.
Well, I think that let's just take the possibility that you might be able to convey some feeling or emotion or some psychological spiritual connection to your animal. I, in the book, I talk about these kinds of connections that are very real between humans and animals. Some of the most dramatic evidence of all has to do with what's called the returning animal experiences. And there are dozens of, actually hundreds of these things that are in the consciousness-oriented literature. In the book, I talk about a collie dog whose family was moving from Indiana to Oregon. And as they were going west from Indiana and the next state over, the dog, whose name is Bobby gets lost. The family's heartbroken. They cannot find this animal, and they have to go on to Oregon, so they abandon the search. Well, 6 months later, the dog shows up at the new house in Oregon. This is not a look-alike animal. I mean, dog is distinguished by several identifying marks and scars and so on. And the dog comes in the house, bounds into bed with the master, and it's Bobby. There's no mistaking it. The question is, how in the world does this animal find the way to the new home over about 2,000 miles in the dead of winter, crossing many bridges and rivers and so on? How is that possible? I think the only thing that makes any sense at all is some sort of mental connection between the owners through a loving thread that we were talking about a moment ago that sort of guides the animal and helps it home in on the loving masters. Mm-hmm. I gave a talk about this to the Smithsonian Institution in D.C. once, and there were some skeptical people in the audience who just would not go there. And we got into this huge discussion where they were not willing to give an inch. And so I said, well, what is your alternative? And one very argumentative man stood up and said, well, it's pheromones. You know, it's these chemicals that help people, you know, identify each other and so on. As totally dismissing the fact that they don't work between species. I mean, these are species-specific chemicals. But he wouldn't be dissuaded. He said, you know, the wind blows from west to east, and so it blew these hormones from the owners over, and the dog picked him up and halfway across the United States and just followed the chemical trail. That's how desperate some people are to not go there with the idea that we may have some sort of psycho-spiritual linkage between species. So I don't find it odd at all that you might be able to give solace and comfort to your grieving pet.
What does, do we have any idea? I mean, are the pets partaking of the one mind?
I think so. This is not an energetic signal that, you know, some squiggly vibration that goes from one person to another. You can't account for the evidence by that kind of model. So I think that this is a non-local, ever-present, infinite kind of consciousness domain in which you and all sentient creatures participate. I really am sort of offended over the years by this idea that that humans are the only people who are sentient. I don't think there's any evidence for that.
Yeah, and much evidence to the contrary sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't. That doesn't make sense to me at all. But people say that a lot. You know, oh, they don't have a higher consciousness. I sometimes feel they know more than we do, and I'm sure part of the reason that people. You know, I feel like they're helping us through this time, actually. And, you know, even as we're taking care of them, the word pet, you know, somehow implies they're lesser or whatever. But, you know, it's you know, of course, one could always be projecting onto them. I've heard people say that, oh, they don't love their the people they're with. Or, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, and yet the fact that this is such a prevalent thing now, people with their animals, it's actually supplying, I think, an essential nutrient in some way that many feel deprived of in our culture, or you know, don't need that additional resourcing. And I feel almost like the animal kingdom is sort of stepped up to kind of give a hand for the sake of the whole earth.
Well, just
but that's just you know, yeah. I don't have any validation for that. That's just my you know my feeling, but.
I just yesterday had a meeting with a physician who is involved in equine therapy with returning veterans from our multiple wars. And these depressed vets, many of whom have traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder, seem to really come around and almost wake up when they're in the presence of these horses who have been selected because of their affinity for human beings. You know, they're totally honest. You can't fool them. They have a way of, you know, really demanding complete openness and honesty from people. You know, most horse lovers, you know that. And so this is just one dramatic example of how animals and humans are coming together these days in many therapeutic programs around the world. It isn't just horses either, by the way. Animal therapy is huge in American hospitals, involving just about any kind of animal you want to imagine. One of the people I mentioned in the book who really had an affinity for dogs was Mark Twain, and he really got his back up when people would say, you know, animals don't go to heaven, and his response with that to that was, well, maybe not, but if dogs don't go to heaven, I want to go where they go.
Oh, boy. I can really resonate with that. That's funny. that's really amazing. Well, you know, it's just, I'll tell you something else. Since we're really here, in this animal vein. But one of the things I do a lot of, kind of a presence on Facebook, a lot of social activism through Facebook, and actually have made a lot of far-flung friends, many of whom I've really come to know, and some of whom I've met in person, through Facebook. And one of the things that I have found is that people with whom I have developed a close bond and real friendship, and often then met them later and really, really, have a lot in common with them, love them dearly and all this kind of thing. A number of them also have, tabby cats with similar looks and names. Not only to my animals, but to their own and each other's. It's almost like the tabbies have, kind of organized, or, there's a tabby affinity group, but it wasn't even, obviously nobody planned it.
Right.
And so who's, and then you find out coincidentally, oh, this person has a tabby, this person has a tabby. Someone posts a picture and you're like, oh my God, that looks so much like one of my animals. Somebody else, you post a picture and they're like, oh my God, your animal's a twin from my animal. And so, I sometimes wonder if the animals are organizing us,
We don't do them, they're doing us.
but we have these weighty matters on our hand that we think we're solving. It's also, I think, wonderful to view through this one mind, the notion that everything, it's not only, I think the Buddhist idea about sentient beings has always been, we should honor and love the aliveness, and the individual beauty and nature of even a rock or anything, which is not known to be sentient, but for, any leaf, any plant, and it's a sense of caretaking. Of empathizing with, of not disconnecting from, of being present to, is kind of implicit in all of that. But the other part of it, which gets a little anthropomorphic, which is a natural tendency of mine that I try to kind of rein in, usually as a science-oriented reporter, but the other side of that is also that I would say that the sentient beings in nature are really helping us all the time, actually. They're helping, all of that is helping humans all the time. And the missing element is the human understanding and gratitude and acknowledgement of that help. We couldn't exist, we couldn't exist a day or an hour without the collaboration of all of everything alive here on Earth that's creating a hospitable, living system environment that supports our very survival and our being and our aliveness and embodiment here on Earth. So the sense that nature even and all of these other natural beings are connected and wanting to help and are helping us, it seems almost if we tune in more to that, there may be more resources of at our disposal than we ordinarily realize.
Well, I think that's very well put. Sometimes this cooperation between humans and animals takes very dramatic form. I go into at length in the book, cases in which humans save the lives of animals. Animals return the favor, of course. There are hundreds of cases on record where humans have given their lives to rescue human beings, and then there are cases where animals rescue one another. Every combination you can think of happens in terms of life-saving, life-giving, life-sacrificing behaviors. I'm very touched by this. I used to apologize for anthropomorphism. That's considered bad manners in science, but I don't much care anymore because I think if you read the record, that's where you wind up. We're not the only one who has feelings and compassionate thoughts.
And so is there, I think I have a very strong natural anthropomorphic bent and have had it since, I was a tiny girl playing with the salamanders, What is the scientific evidence for that? That part of this I haven't really heard. I'm very interested in that. And I just want to interject for our listeners who may have tuned in that we're talking with Larry Dossey, the author of One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters.
So, well, the evidence is, I think, all over the place in terms of a non-local quality of consciousness. And I'll just say once again, that's just the idea based on many, many experiments that you can't confine or lock up consciousness in a brain. Consciousness behaves in ways that escape the brain. Consciousness can do things that brains cannot do. There are many areas now where we see this. There are thousands of demonstrations now of tightly controlled experiments in remote viewing, telepathic exchanges at great distances between not just people, but people and animals. This idea that consciousness can interact with things beyond the person, the person's individual body, knows no limits. I mean, it goes beyond humans communicating with other sentient beings. We communicate even with presumably non-sentient entities such as computers. There are many hundreds of examples now of where people can influence the output of random number generators at a distance, even from global distances. So the idea that consciousness gets around and permeates not just human-to-human axes, but human-to-animal and human-to-non-sentient entities such as computers is an idea that we might as well accept, because the evidence is just overwhelming that that's the way consciousness operates. So it shouldn't be a struggle, I think, for us to acknowledge that we interchange thoughts and feelings and so on with other sentient beings such as animals. I mean, that's only part of it. We do the same thing with non-sentient entities such as computers.
Yeah, well, that's the random number generators and all of all of that too. You know, one of the things I think, and you've written about this a lot, is that we have, you know, which has to do with, you know, precognition or intuition or whatever. You know, I think that there's kind of, it almost feels like there's a gradation, because like I very often will feel that I'm not intuiting something, I'm reading conditions that lead in a certain direction. And then I notice that before it goes there, but I'm recognizing patterns or conditions prior to something actually manifesting.
Right.
And to me, that doesn't feel intuitive. It just feels like learning patterns and you know, being a good observer and feeler into a situation. But then it could go on from there to people who are, you know, or claiming to talk to departed souls. And, you know, in other words, there's a whole, you know, or in their bodies sensing earth events. There's like a whole, I know people who do that. There's like a whole spectrum there.
Right.
And everyone is kind of in a different place of capacity and receptivity. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I think some of this knowing that you're referring to is not conscious intuition or subtle knowing in terms of awareness. It's deeper than that. Even unconscious knowing, even though that sounds paradoxical. I bumped into this, Allison, when I was a battalion surgeon out in the boonies in Vietnam back in 68 and 69. I took care of kids who were on the front lines in combat every day. And many of them would tell me that they had some sort of sixth sense that would alert them to when they were about to be killed. And I will never forget one lad who told me, "Doc," he said, "you don't have to know very far ahead of time." He said, "sometimes only a second or two is enough." And in combat situations, these experiences are extremely common. They have survival value. And if you were to predict where you would see these abilities, it would be perhaps in a combat situation, because they do help people survive. So these kids weren't talking about anything that we would call conscious awareness or intuition. This was something extremely subtle, so subtle that they would behave in ways that they couldn't even explain. They had no ability to be rational about this sort of thing. It just was something that was just in their gut that they just responded to automatically without even conscious awareness of it. So I think these sorts of the spectrum of knowing, which you mentioned a moment ago, it goes really deep in terms of our psychology, even to the level of the deep unconscious. There are now about 20 cases that Dr. Larry Burke, who's a radiologist, has collected of women, for example, who have dreams which by definition are not conscious, we're not consciously aware of breast cancer. And so they go to the doctor. There's the exam is normal, the mammogram is normal, but the biopsy, which the woman insists on having, shows that the dream was correct, even points out where they should have done the biopsy in order to detect the cancer. This is a kind of unconscious knowing that is so deep that it you don't have it when you're awake. It comes to you, it bubbles up from the unconscious in dreams when we don't censor or sanction the information that the unconscious is delivering to us. And just like in combat, it's survival-oriented. If you neglect it, then the cancer may not be discovered before it's curable. So there are a million ways in which this non-local knowing manifests in people's lives in extremely valuable ways.
Yeah, and it's working on, I mean, we're participating in it all on a collective level as well. And that is a resource in, you know, kind of promoting the survival of hospitable ecology and social systems for thriving and surviving on planet Earth. How, you know, do you have any suggestions of how we can tune into the one mind for, you know, with that kind of intention, or tune into what the one mind is kind of allowing us to know about what, you know, how to kind of protect and serve in this world situation we're in?
Well, I think there are ways that we can access this level of awareness. The key point is, going into this, is to recognize that we don't have to make this happen. I mean, this is not something we have to manufacture. It's our possession. The trick is, or the goal is simply to invite it to manifest and show up in our lives. And so the question is always not how you make it happen, but how can you invite this to manifest in your life? There are time-honored ways of doing this. Of course, meditation has long been a favored way of getting the conscious mind out of the way and letting something from deep in our being well up, unobstructed, and just simply manifest to our conscious awareness. Meditation is just a hugely productive way to come into this. There are 15 million Americans now who have come into the awareness through near-death experiences. I don't go around recommending this because near-death experiences don't always turn around and, you know, come back in this direction.
oh my God!
But there are other ways where this comes, this awareness opens up and takes us by surprise. We call those instances epiphanies. They're extremely common. They are unpredictable. They come about in the most mundane, almost comical ways sometimes. You know, when we are doing nothing or have our minds preoccupied by gardening or listening to music or viewing great art or something like that. And these are just sudden revelations where, you know, it's like getting zapped. I mean, in the common description is that all of a sudden you feel at one with everything. You feel a part of everything. You're connected through a feeling of deep, intense love and caring for everything. These tend to be permanent. People who experience these don't go through, you know, back through the eye of the needle in the other direction. I mean, this can be transformative in people's lives. Many people who have a so-called parapsychological experience of telepathy or clairvoyance with someone at a distance, or maybe who is not even alive any longer, are often transformed, and they see the world in a completely different way. Mm. I had experiences like that the first year I was in medical practice through a series of precognitive dreams where I dreamt the outcome of clinical events in my patients before they would even happen. This mm-hmm. showed me that the world didn't work the way I was taught, mm-hmm. and I had to make allowances for that. So what I'm saying is that there are a million ways how these things can happen if we will just get out of the way and invite them into our lives and attempt to make a place for them.
Mm-hmm. Making a place for them in terms of time, in terms of how we understand them,
exactly.
in terms of certain practices.
Yeah, setting a time, for example, to sit down, be quiet, and see what happens. You know, one can call that meditation or contemplation or just simply getting quiet. It doesn't matter. But being dedicated and disciplined in our daily rounds and intentionally setting aside a time and a place to permit that to take place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's easy enough. If, you know, everyone's feeling they're so busy and there's always so much to do. But, you know, I think it's really important. We're here on this world, you know, in this world, in this way, at this time, and you know, doing that, I think, is really important. I think that's beautifully said. You know, are you working on another book after this one? Because this seems like such an enormous thing, and I know that as a writer, you're always, you know, sort of looking round the bend. It may be too soon to ask this question.
I like round the bend. That's a good phrase. You know, the manuscript for this book was originally extremely sprawling, and mm-hmm. so half of it was eliminated just to make it readable. So I think uh-huh. I have a sequel to it around the bend. But life is so rich, and it presents me with so much material that mm-hmm. I don't think I'm going to have much trouble in following this up with another similar book about how consciousness manifests in a non-local, one-mind way. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm already edging up on jumping into the next manuscript, so thanks for the nudge.
Well, I know you, so I was kind of guessing, that might be the case, although everyone needs a breather, too. But we're talking to Larry Dossey about One Mind, how our individual mind is part of a greater consciousness and why it matters. I hope, readers, that you will go out and get and read this book. And if you haven't read Larry Dossey's work before, you're in for a treat in this book, as well as he has a whole lineage, a literary lineage of books that he's written that you can also get to know. So I'm the kind of person who actually likes prolific authors because when I like their work, I don't want it to be over. I always want there to be more that I can read. And so this is certainly, you are wealthy, and we are wealthy in what you give us.
Thank you,
Larry Dossey. So thank you so much for being with me today on Connected Dots.
Great.
It's fun having you. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Have a wonderful week. Remember to give thanks to all that you have in your life as we approach the holiday. And I give thanks to you, Larry. So join us next week. My soul.